Welcome to the Debate at Geo8 podcast series, exploring issues and research affecting the Group of Eight universities and, by extension, Australia's economy and our society. The Group of Eight comprises Australia's leading research-intensive universities, the universities of Melbourne, Sydney, Queensland, Western Australia, Adelaide, the Australian National University, Monash University, and UNSW Sydney. Today, we'll be taking a closer look at research being undertaken at Adelaide University, which has enormous potential benefits for primary producers in the Indo-Pacific region and Australia's standing among our near neighbours. Well, today we've stocked up with a well-earned supply of some high-end luxury Haig's chocolate. Now, there's good reason for this pod booth excess. And to explain why, we have in the studio Professor Wendy Umberger from Adelaide University. Hello, Wendy. And her recently retired colleague, Professor Randy Stringer, and the CEO of the Group of Eight, Vicky Thompson. Now, Professors Randy Stringer and Wendy Umberger have been doing a great deal of research with the Centre for Global Food and Resources and with cocoa farmers in Vanuatu. To you first, Randy, what's this work involved?
Hi, Ron. Thanks for having us this afternoon. Listen, this project is funded by the Australian Centre for International Agricultural Research. We all call it ACR.
Yeah.
And there was a good reason ACR was interested in cocoa producers in Vanuatu, because Vanuatu has about 300,000 population, 75% are rural, and 35% of those produce cocoa.
So what were the problems with the cocoa that they were producing?
The Germans, the Americans, the Australians, the United Nations had been in there all working on yields and production. But shortly after the project ends, all those practices are dropped that they've been trying to get adoption of by these producers. The practices that the producers were doing, they were in selling this crop, they were getting a very low price. Their cocoa beans, are being sent off to Singapore, then over to Malaysia, going into Cadbury's, mixed in with everybody else's chocolate. So they had no feedback. They had no idea where their chocolate ended up.
So no connection with the chocolate makers at all, really. Just supply the stuff and it's gone.
No, in fact, they had never tasted chocolate.
Wow.
These growers. Yeah. They'd been growing chocolate for three or four generations, but never had chocolate.
Amazing.
What we decided to do was reached out to some pretty amazing chocolate makers. So Haig's, of course, they were here in Adelaide. Josh Bayan out of Bayan & Co. in Margaret River, who was trained here in Adelaide as a winemaker and went into chocolate making. Then we reached out to this amazing, one of the most amazing chocolate makers on the planet, Gary Guittard in San Francisco, and Rodney Nichols in Amsterdam. Now, Haig's was easy because we were here, we knew, so we went and talked to him and said, look, can you give us a hand? We'd like to send you samples of these beans, and could you tell us, we're not trying to talk you into buying anything, we just need some help. What's the gap in the quality from the beans you buy and the beans that these producers from these different villages are sending out? And so we'd like to get feedback. So we asked all these chocolate makers that. They all sent back some amazing reports to it. They analyzed it differently. Some of them, Gary Guittard, they had analysis DNA. They had other people, Haig's, roasted it, tasted it, went through the beans, and they all gave us this amazing feedback.
Sounds like my sort of research, which we're going to do later.
But essentially, they all said the same thing. They said, these beans are crap.
Right.
And said, you could triple your production. We're not buying them. We could never buy them. But the best news for us, they said, listen, how do we help? How can we get in here and help you? I mean, Gary Guittard says, we can, even if you had great quality, we can't buy these because we only do single variety beans. We were going to produce a chocolate bar. But the others, everybody else was saying, look, how do we help? And that's what started changing everything. And thanks to Josh Bain, who said, we'll do more than help. I'm going to make chocolate out of these different samples from eight of these villages. And can I go with you over to Vanuatu? So for the first time in their lives, these villagers not only tasted chocolate, but they tasted chocolate made from the cocoa beans from their village.
Oh, right.
They hated it too.
Really?
So they knew they had work to do.
They knew they had work to do. They tasted it and they were going, oh my God, why do you guys eat this stuff? It tastes like cardboard. It's moldy. It's terrible. Yeah. And Josh said, well, wait, hang on. Try this from Madagascar. Try this bar. Try this bar from Venezuela. So they tasted this and they go, this is unbelievable. What did you do to this? What you put in here? And Josh, same recipe, exactly the same recipe, 75% cocoa, 25%.
So it's saying to them, it's what you grow.
Well, it turns out that production really wasn't the problem. It's like wine grapes or it's like coffee. You need, as soon as you get the coffee pod and you take out those beans, the seeds that are beans, you have to ferment it within 24 hours. And it needs to reach a certain temperature because that's where all those amazing flavors come. So you want to get up to 50 degrees Celsius. Then you need to, and that takes 5 or 6 days, maybe 7. And then after that, you dry it and you have to dry it. They were doing all of that wrong. And that's what the reports came back and said. They knew that the beans had picked too early. They hadn't fermented properly and they hadn't dried it. So you get the mold because of the moisture. So those were the issues. But once they tasted chocolate, they said, we get it. And how much, and Josh says, here's what I paid for these cocoa beans, which is about 6-7 times higher than a price than they're ever going to get for theirs. So the focus became on the quality post-production because Wendy and I are economists. For us, if you get the incentive there, the production is going to take care of itself. Mm. That's why they were dropping those practices from all those projects in the first place, is because it wasn't worth it. It's not worth their time. But raise the price 5 or 6 times, 4 times, and they're ready to do all these practices.
And Wendy, that's been happening? They're getting better prices?
Yeah. They're getting, how much would the price have gone up, Randy?
Look, what we've seen for the cocoa producers, they're getting 3 or 4 times the price. So instead of making $200 net from their coffee cocoa bean sale, they're getting $800. So not only are they paying for the school fees, they're putting solar panels on their houses so their kids can study at night.
Wow. Yeah. And that must be, as researchers to you, Wendy, that must be a great feeling to have a direct impact on the lives of these people.
I mean, ultimately, as researchers, that's why we're in the game. We want to drive change at a direct level and benefit someone. And that's actually what's been so rewarding about the work that Randy's doing in his project, or any of, I guess, this ACR work that we're doing, is you actually get to see the direct impact that this is having on the smallholders in Vanuatu or in other research in Indonesia, but also on the businesses as well. So it's not just smallholders, but it's other people in that value chain in terms of the rewards and benefits, the students that get to interface and work on these projects. So in Randy's case, actually one of our Masters of Agribusiness students participated in that project, Layla, and she ended up, I think it probably helped her get an employment after, because she'd had this hands-on experience because she did her research project. You know, they have to do a short research project, and she did the research project on that. It gave her a leg up, and she was able to get a position with a multinational wine company.
Fantastic.
So it's just the impact that this research has, on probably people we expect to directly impact, in this case, smallholders, but then also kind of the other people, the students, the researchers, the government. There was aspects of this project that I know benefited training for the government in terms of research methods.
Do you think that the broader Australian community understands all of that infrastructure that sits behind, and I'm talking about the people and the commitment, because you've put it so elegantly that we're not doing research for research's sake, and that's a strong message that as research-intensive universities, we're really keen for people to understand. But do you think the broader community understands all that sits behind what you've just explained today?
No, I think that probably most people's perceptions of any university, and particularly GO8s, where there might be knowledge that they're more research-intensive than some of the non-GO8s, is that, we do more laboratory research, probably things focused on health or more basic science and teaching. And that's if you're on a plane talking to someone and you say you're an academic, that's what do you teach? Mm. And, what they think you work in a laboratory. And our work, I think that's what keeps me in academia, and is this ability to actually have impact. And you see the growth in your students, whether it be a domestic Australian student or one of our international students, you see how they change from getting to work directly on a research project that involves industry from our country in Australia, as well as industry, small, medium, whatever size, international partners. And what was really cool about Randy's project is the way that Heggs and Behan and company stepped up, because they really wanted to play a role. And I think they saw value in it as well in terms of learning more about that supply chain, a potential source for cocoa, because many companies were wanting to do single origin traceable products in cocoa. You know, there's soft diplomacy aspects of it. Actually, the work that we do with the Australian Centre for International Agricultural Research, I reckon the Australian citizen would be so proud of the relationships that are built through that research in terms of, you know, across Asia, Pacific, Africa, most countries, actually, there would be people who had been involved in ACR research and worked with GOA universities, mm-hmm. whether it's the University of Adelaide or UQ or Monash University. All GOAs are in this space. And it actually helps with disease control, biopest issues. Many pests are kept from coming into Australia because of the work that we've done learning about diseases on more technical projects because of this work with ACR. But the relationships. So I think because of 40 years of ACR research with universities here, the Australian government can walk into most countries and there's partners that have been involved in this research. And those partners in our overseas partner countries know the value of that work and that trust in that relationship mm-hmm. because we've worked collaboratively. You can't put a price on that. That's a deep relationship.
You can't put a price on chocolate like this, and I'm determined to have some. And I can smell it. I mean, that's the other thing.
It smells great.
So why don't we all just grab a piece?
Yeah. Do we have to?
Yeah, and we can talk about, Randy, what you're looking for in your research, you know, the qualities that you look for. What are you looking for? What are the discussions you've had with the people in Vanuatu and other Pacific Islands about the way in which they can improve their chocolate?
Look, I think in terms of what you're looking for, and I'm just parroting here because mm-hmm. these chocolate makers, I'm just repeating what mm-hmm. they tell me, what they learned. They're like, what we're tasting today is going to be dark chocolate, 75%, 60%, 75%. And essentially you want white cane sugar because, as I'm told, that's not going to impart any other flavor. So what you're going to taste is just the chocolate. Now, all of us love milk chocolate and we love having cardamom in it or raisins or sea salt, one of my favorites. But this is what they would be tasting is something that's 70, 80%. And so they're trying to understand and capture the kinds of fruit flavors. When you see the cocoa tasters, they're doing the same thing like the wine tasters or olive oil. They go through a process to really, you know, what's in the front of your mouth, the middle of the mouth, and the back of the mouth.
What I'm amazed at is that, as you said, this is the first time that many of these growers actually got to meet a chocolate maker. And they've been sending this product away. And it just points to the fact that, you know, it's being sent away, but they're lost in the process. They're a step removed from where they need to be.
Yeah, it is interesting. But look, in Vanuatu now, it's very different. I mean, in two of the producers that the project was working with, and especially through one of our colleagues there, who Heggs and Josh Bain trained to be a chocolate maker, because again, those groups who set the research agenda. We reorganized the project around what they said needed to be done these post-harvest, but also the importance of getting quick feedback. So they said, look, Sandrine's there with Active. She can make these chocolate bars, and she can give them immediate. Hmm. And so they trained her. They trained her up. They help her buy equipment. They go through all of this. You often think about, competition, you know, we can't, this could, but no, it's not the way it is at all. So they're very, very helpful with that. And doing this kind of training, what makes a good chocolate, what different markets are looking for. And as Wendy said, everybody's looking now for these, you know, niche markets. Yeah. And
I was going to ask you about that. You talked about the single variety bean. Is that a bit like winemaking where, you know, you get to a single vineyard and it's so exclusive that, you know, it has a certain premium? Could you create a market for these Vanuatu cocoa producers if they get the bean calibers exactly right?
Mm, this is good, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
So I think that's something that the growers are aware of now. And so they're doing a new project, so they're helping them graft so they can graft these new varieties on. And there's a really interesting project that because the project's been extended, where working with Mars and the USDA on DNA testing to know what the varieties that are there. And they've got all these hybrids because the Germans essentially dropped off these cocoa plants back in the 1880s or whatever, and they've just been, you know, sort of hybrid ever since. So So they're really focusing now on the most important thing is you can't grow Vanuatu cocoa anywhere else but Vanuatu. Mm. So they've got that scarcity. Yeah. And there's not a lot of it. There's more and more all the time. But the second part is these post-harvest. And there's a real issue on drying because you need to dry it in the sun. You don't want to have fires or smoke around it because you get smoke taint. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, most of those islands, Vanuatu, get a lot more sun than many other places. Sorry, a lot more cloud cover. Mm. So it's a more so that's a big challenge for them to find using local materials and to find ways that they can innovate to.
That's fantastic.
To you, Vicky, though, this typifies Group of Eight sort of research, doesn't it?
Oh, it's just such a great example of the research that we do across our universities. And I think Wendy, you know, raised several points around the soft diplomacy aspect. You cannot underestimate that given that this is happening in our region. Mm. And the Indo-Pacific region, it's where we live, it's where we operate, it's where we prosper. And so it's actually quite, it's exciting to hear the research you're doing. And also highlighting the fact that research is a global pursuit. Mm. You know, it doesn't happen in isolation, as you know. And, you know, we've got two researchers here who are economists, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Working on chocolate and helping people in Vanuatu, but also bringing with them PhD students and their learning and their working with industry. And that is happening at scale across the Group of Eight universities. We do 70% of all university-based research in Australia. So we're the heavy lifters in that regard. And I think this is just one example of that research, which is having real impact on families, but also in terms of that soft diplomacy side, which we can't ever underestimate.
And to you, Wendy, you're also involved in another project involving another near neighbour. Tell us about the work that you're doing in Indonesia with milk production, because obviously milk production's essential to chocolate production as well. What's going on there?
Yeah, so this project, again, it's funded by the Australian Centre for International Agricultural Research. It's led by the University of Adelaide, but we have a really strong partner on it called Subtropical Dairy. So basically Queensland Dairy. And so kind of the technical lead on it, as I'm the economist, is an industry partner. And that's really unique. So the main aim of that project was similar to Randy's. Initially, when we started, it was to increase the productivity of smallholder dairies in Indonesia. And about 80% of Indonesia's domestic milk supply comes from smallholder dairies. Now, to define a smallholder dairy, it's anywhere from 3 to, you might have 20, but the average would be 4 dairy cows.
Oh, wow.
So they're quite small. And, you know, Indonesia has a massive population and growing demand for dairy, and they aim to have self-sufficiency by basically the middle of the 2020s.
But they only produce about a fifth of their needs now, right?
Right.
So you've got 230 million Indonesians.
Right. And so Indonesia, in terms of what they domestically supply, it's mostly what we call short shelf life milk, so fresh. And that's where the demand's really growing, because if they're trying to produce anything that's, you know, longer term, they're competing in really this global powdered milk area, and it's difficult to compete because that's with large multinationals, large scale dairies. So, and where the demand is this high quality fresh milk. And so the project was really, first we were just focusing on trying to increase output per animal or per farm. And what we found out when we engaged with the processors, so the end users of that product, was really that quality, they needed first quality to be addressed in order to kind of continue to grow the demand for domestic milk. So they wanted to start creating products that were sourced from Indonesia, because just like here, we'd prefer to have domestic products. Indonesians are no different. They take great pride in their domestic production and wanted more domestic milk. They viewed it as being safer and wanting to support smallholders there. So, you know, there was plenty of technology that dairy farmers had been exposed to through pretty decent extension systems there. But what we were seeing is that the farmers weren't adopting that technology. So they maybe had been given information and training about how to increase output. You know, to a lot of it was addressing disease issues, maybe breeding. The breeds were actually pretty good. They're not that different than what we have here. But there were disease issues, but milk quality ultimately was something where we could have a relatively quick turnaround. Mm. And so we got a processor to partner with us, a it's massively growing, the processor. It's called Chimery, and they're focused on high quality domestically. They do, obviously, most of their products come from, use international milk, but they want to grow the domestic supplies of really high-end products and healthy products. So healthy, safe, domestically sourced. And so that processor worked with us. And we learned with the dairy scientists in terms of what were the issues with getting quality milk. And then, you know, I'm the leader, but actually my scientific role was understanding how we could drive behavior change. So in some ways, it's similar to Randy's, where we looked at this value chain and tried to look at where's the breakdown in issues. And we identified quality as a breakdown. Farmers might know what they need to do to improve quality, but they need an incentive to do it. And so we got Chimery, the milk processor, to agree to pay incentives to farmers if they could produce higher quality milk. And then we went in and used innovative extension techniques as well. So there's was research going into what types of extension techniques, what types of incentives, what types of business models would help drive behavior change. And what we found out is that if we could get the right incentive in there and we could give farmers, similar to what Randy did in the cocoa project, we needed to give them feedback on what type of product are they producing. They had no idea what was the quality of their product. Actually, some of them hadn't tasted milk either. They didn't have any idea where it was going or who was using it. In fact, most of them had no idea.
And if you get the quality right, suddenly you can make more product.
Yep.
And you can make more high-end product and get a better price for it.
Exactly. And so we had to then, there's kind of a middleman. So most of the farmers have to sell their milk through a cooperative, pseudo public private cooperative, and they need to be members of this cooperative. So we also had to engage really closely with the cooperative to get them on board, because the price payment had to come through the cooperative. So it was a lot of learning about behavioral science, as well as how the value chain works, so the business side of it, and then a lot of technological research. But most of the technological research had already been done, and many of the research agencies we were working with in Indonesia had been trained, actually, at a GOA, for example, in Australia. There's really close linkages there.
And that is a really important point too, that cross-disciplinary research that you've talked about, behavioral science, economists, you know, a range of other people, technicians, et cetera, all involved in research. And that's the other point. We talk about research being a global pursuit, but it's also a multidisciplinary pursuit as well. And that is something that is a hallmark of the research intensive universities like the Group of Eight. But it is true for all universities in the world, actually, that the best research comes from teams of people from different disciplines working together. I've just got a quick question on, you know, people are listening to this in the context of COVID.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, you're working in the Indo-Pacific region. There's a lot happening in that region, aside from just COVID, of course. And I'm just wondering for both of you, question for both of you, what's the impact been for you on your research, but even just sort of anecdotally, how you think, you know, how do we continue to do research in this global context that we're in with a challenging geopolitical climate in the region that we're in? So sort of two questions there. Yeah.
So the impact on COVID, the impact of COVID on our research, it could have been completely limiting. So we were right in the middle of this, what we called a price incentive study. We just started it and I think just before Adelaide shut down, I was on one of the last flights back from working on this project. And we were really concerned we were going to lose the investment we'd had in this project and the momentum we'd gained. But actually, because we had such strong partnerships there, and we had people, we call them village level researchers, actually living in the area and working with the farmers, and it hadn't yet, COVID actually in Indonesia had not yet gotten out to the village level. So we were able to keep the research going through technology. WhatsApp is something we were using and communicating with our partners every day. And then as COVID got worse in Indonesia, we had to stop letting people going out to the farm, but we were able to use, you know, the phones and the relationship to keep the research going. So had we not had good relationships there with our project partners, again, for many years, I mean, Randy, one of the first projects we did together in 2007 was in Indonesia. And so working with some of the same kind of institutions there.
Relationships.
And, yep, the relationships. Yeah. And that has, that bond in that, that actually some of them did PhDs with us. And had we not had that, we would have had to completely stop that
research.
And that
goes to the strength of the people-to-people relationships that research actually underpins in that soft diplomacy kind of discussion that we were having previously.
It must have a huge impact on the way Australia's perceived throughout the Indo-Pacific, you know, Indo-Pacific with the work that both of you have done.
It does, and you build up. I mean, we're now getting, you know, students coming back to University of Melbourne, to UQ, Adelaide, that their parents are, you know, through this system and they have that attachment. But I think going back to something Vicky said that I think is so important in those relationships, because it's not a multidisciplinary, as Vicky was saying, but also as she said about those partnerships you have with other researchers. And I think a lot of us, you know, we just take that for granted. It's just, there it is. And that's what you do. You have conferences, you meet with people. And I think what's happened with COVID for a lot of us is we don't take that for granted anymore. If you're on Zoom all the time with everyone, with all of our partners, we still have monthly, you know, meetings with everybody and weekly with individual partners. But these projects have 8 or 9 partners, 2 or 3, you know, group of 8 universities, and then our partners in the country. So I think that the importance of those relationships, that's what we were able to draw on. And now really, you know, don't take it for granted anymore, because that is so important into being able to find new ways and everyone, you know, thinking through how we're going to be able to carry out this. A lot of the work Wendy and I do, you do field surveys. You've got to do, you know, one-on-one out there in these households, interviewing the male and the female head of households to get all this information. And you know, you're not going to be sending teams out these days. So, well, what else can you do? Well, a lot of people have phones. Almost everybody, even in Vanuatu, they have phones. So, you know, there's other things that everybody's been able to pitch in and come up with ideas on how to solve some problems so we can keep moving.
We'll have to leave it there. There's nothing left for us to do but
eat chocolate.
Okay.
So eat chocolate. Thank you so much for coming
in.
Thank you.
Thanks for your company today. If you'd like more information about the issues raised in this podcast or other related topics, please visit our website at go8.edu.au. And a quick reminder that you can always tune in to Debate at Go8 on Spotify, Google, Apple, or YouTube. Bye for now.